The next case to be heard is number 2015-791. It's Notestein Manor versus Logan County Board of Revision. The appellant is the county. And we'll hear argument from Ms. Gorey.
Yes, thank you very much. May it please the court, I'm Kelly Gorey of Rich & Gillis Law Group, and I'm here today on behalf of the county appellants, Logan County Auditor, and Logan County Board of Revision. And the Honorable Mike Yoder is here with me today. In brief, this is a Section 202 property that was recently built. The property owner purchased the land approximately 6 months prior to the lien date in an arm's length transaction for the purchase price of $145,000. Construction on the property, I believe, began immediately. We're dealing with tax year 2013 today. And as of the 1/1/13 lien date, the property was 67% complete. The owner obtained a capital advance, which is essentially a grant from HUD under the Section 202 program. And I believe the amount of that grant was about $1.5 million to construct the 11 units. And the property was completed in approximately, I think, end of March of 2013. And at the BOR, at the BTA, the owner presented an appraisal of Cynthia Hatton Tepe, who, based upon the BTA's interpretation of Woda Ivy Glen, used the actual restricted rents for the property to value the property at $100,000 as if it was fully complete, which it was not as of the lien date. So she then applied an actual rent loss to go back to the lien date and arrived at a value of $75,000 as of the lien date. I believe the only issue here today, since the Network Restoration's 3 decision has been issued by the court, is whether or not that decision applies to this appeal.
Well, the Network Restoration's case, though, involved an appraisal that used market rents, did it not?
Well, correct. But the court in Network Restoration's, in my opinion, was very clear that it was reversing the BTA's interpretation of Woda Ivy Glen as to LIHTC properties. In fact, the second heading of the decision is that Woda Ivy Glen does not require an actual rent approach. That's exactly what the owner's appraiser did here. They used an actual rent approach.
But isn't there a distinction between, in terms of interpreting the opinion, between whether an actual rent approach would be required as a matter of law or whether it might be permitted under appropriate circumstances?
I see what you're saying. We did not present a market rent appraisal in this case. That is correct. But it is our position that Network Restorations is clear that it is legal error to appraise a low-income subsidized housing property using the actual restricted rents. And the basis for that is, I believe the court was quite clear in setting forth 3 rules that apply to all low-income subsidized residential properties.
Let me just be clear, sure. Though, in my recollection of Network Restorations, there was a market rent appraisal, and the BTA said that it would not accept the market rent appraisal because it ought to be an actual rent appraisal.
No, yes, correct, because there was an overlying LIHTC restriction on that property.
And this court reversed that.
Correct.
Result. And you read that as how? How do you read that?
that the three rules, the court first acknowledged that there are problems with valuing subsidized housing. And one of those problems is that the parties aren't typically motivated. They receive valuable subsidies, construction funds that can be through income tax credits. Here it was a grant to construct the property in exchange for the rental restrictions. And what the Board of Education had argued in Network Restorations that was that the BTA's interpretation of this court's decision in WOTA was in error, and the court generally agreed and set forth the three rules for valuing low-income subsidized housing. And the first one is that because the use of the property and the market and the actual rents may not be representative of what typical market participants would be doing in the market, you have to use actual rents. You have to use market rents and market expenses in an income approach. And then the second rule was basically from Alliance Towers and also WOTA, that you won't consider the affirmative benefit of the subsidies. So here that would be considering any portion of the $1.5 million grant they received for construction. And we certainly are not asking this court to consider that in any way. We're not advocating for a cost approach. And then the third rule was that a continuation of existing law that the cost approach is not used to value subsidized housing because it overvalues the property, because ordinary market participants wouldn't have incurred the cost in the first place. So if you apply those three rules here, the owner's appraisal is unlawful. It doesn't follow what the court has set forth as the way we value all subsidized housing in Ohio.
But you would agree that you can't point to a case where this court has said you may never use an actual rent appraisal.
I believe that Network Restorations does in fact do that.
Okay.
And one of the reasons is because I think that the court was quite clear in choosing language such that it was not limiting its decision to either straight LIHTC properties or LIHTC properties with a Section 8 property with a LIHTC overlay. And one of the reasons for that is when they're first discussing the problems with subsidized housing, they mention two things that subsidized housing contains, which is usually subsidized funds for construction or renovation, which we have here. The owner received the $1.5 million grant to construct the property, which they didn't have to pay back at any time so long as they complied with the rent restrictions. And this is in paragraph 16 of Network Restorations. And then the court also says that there can be rent subsidies that the government entity pays to help the tenants pay their portion of the rent. In fact, we do have both of those things here. And then in the following paragraph, the court says, broadly speaking, the case law resolves the problems that we have with subsidized housing. And then it proceeds to set forth the three rules. I think that in my opinion, the court's choice of the language by using words like broadly speaking conveyed an intent to not limit Network Restorations to only the circumstances of that particular case. I believe the court was intending to apply that decision to every subsidized housing property in which there were funds received for construction and or rental subsidies. So it's our position that Network Restorations applies here without distinction, and the owner's appraisal does not follow the three rules. She utilized the actual rents. And just another comment about how the rents are set here. HUD sets the initial budget based upon the 30% of the income that the tenants are able to pay. And then because that rent is insufficient to cover the operating expenses, HUD pays the difference through what's called the PRAC. It's a project rental assistance contract.
Did the appraisal here take that amount into account?
It did. Yes. Yes. She used the total rents, which were $407 a month, in her income approach. But the problem with that is that if the rents are set to simply cover the operating expenses, you have no net operating income. And that was one of the arguments in my brief, is that if you're using the actual rents and you get no operating income, you're either going to always have a negative or a zero or up to $1,000 in net operating income. When you capitalize that, you're essentially getting a zero value.
Let me ask you a question, somewhat a more philosophical level,
sure,
of this whole thing. With these government-subsidized properties, there are all these rules. Well, you can't take into account certain things because they're intangibles that are government subsidies. Is it the case that in valuing these properties, there's a certain amount of almost a fictional character that the tribunals have to treat these properties as if they were something other than they are, as if they were actual market,
yes,
in an actual market that in some sense they're not actually in?
Yes. And I believe the reason for that is clear from Network Restorations, because you have an extreme benefit on this end, which is free or nearly free construction funds, but then you have a significant burden, which is agreeing to reduce the rents to essentially, in some cases, very, very, very inexpensive. So I think what the court was saying in Network Restorations, and this is when they're discussing what that problem is that considering one end or the other is always going to arrive at a value that can't represent the bricks and sticks of the property. So we have land here that was purchased for $145,000 less than 6 months prior to the lien date. And then a $1.5 million apartment complex was built on the property, yet somehow improving the property with the apartment units devalued the land by half. That's an absolutely absurd result. And I think that's what the court is recognizing in Network Restorations, is if you peel away the effects of the subsidies on both sides, so let's not consider the benefit. In other words, let's not consider the value that could come from the tax credits. Let's not consider the $1.5 million construction costs of this property. But on the other hand, if you're not considering any of that benefit, you can't simultaneously consider only the burden, which is exactly what is happening here. So we're only looking at what they agreed to in exchange for receiving the subsidy, yet nothing whatsoever from that beneficial subsidy.
Let me ask you another question. Sorry,
sure,
to interrupt you there.
No problem.
The year here is 2013.
Correct.
And the court has held that the amended statute in the Terrazza 8 case applies to 2013 cases. What effect does that have on the analysis of this case?
Sure, and that was going to be my next thing on my outline. In my opinion, now that we have Network Restorations that indicates that WOTA never required an actual rent income approach, what we're left with is that there was never a lawful actual rent income approach, and the proper interpretation of the statute would be under existing law, which is Alliance Towers and Muirfield, which require the auditor to only consider in valuing the property those involuntary governmental actions like eminent domain, escheat, zoning. These are all voluntary obligations that are entered into by the owner. In my opinion, just adding the words subject to the effect of police power restrictions in the statute, now that we have the court reversing the BTA's interpretation of WOTA, I don't think that that language in the statute is going to codify WOTA as it's been reversed. In my opinion, they're certainly going to have to be, if that was, regardless of whether or not that was the intent, and I haven't seen any legislative history, none is cited in Appellee's brief, that that was actually the intent, but I don't see how we get there with merely the language in the current statute. My opinion is that if the language does anything at all, it reinforces what the court has held WOTA now means. And we have nothing left but Alliance Towers and Canton Towers, which were never reversed by WOTA, as the court confirmed in Network Restorations 3. And then just a final quick point, and I think it's a, and I think, I believe I raised it in my brief, a practical example of why this doesn't work. So since 2009, the BTA has been taking the actual rents from any subsidized housing property where the rents are below market. When they're above market, they're still applying Alliance Towers. And we end up having what could be three or four or five identical properties right next to each other, constructed with the exact same everything. But we will have, and I think the example I used was a 600% difference in value, simply because you're only looking at the burden from the subsidy.
Okay. Thank you. Your time has expired. We're hearing argument from Ms. Bauernschmidt.
If it may please the court, my name is Karen Bauernschmidt. I'm the attorney for Notestein Manor. Notestein Manor is an affordable housing project. It is a Section 202 PRAC. It's one building, 11 units, all one bedroom, one bath units with 540 square feet. And as the appellant county stated, the rent is $407 a month. That means if every unit is rented for the entire year, the total rental income that this property could achieve is $53,724. Now, why would somebody spend, as the appellant stated, $1,500,000 for construction if, in fact, they were only going to get $53,000 a year for rent and then have to pay all the expenses? And that rent of $407 also includes utilities. Now, the Section 202 PRAC program where this particular property was constructed under is solely for nonprofits. Ownership is always going to be a nonprofit for the entire 40-year restriction period. In addition, the rent of $407, as testified to by Mr. Bender, who was the president of Notestein Manor, is frozen for the first 3 years. So that's all the income that that property can generate. In addition, and the county pointed out, there was a capital advance for the construction. However, that you have to wait till the 40-year period, and if that compliance is taken for the entire 40-year period, then and only then is the construction cost and that grant actually extinguished.
Let me ask you a factual question.
Yes.
Is there deed restrictions that are recorded on this property?
There are restrictions, and those are in the record. There's both a regulatory agreement, and it states the 40-year restriction. It also states they can't transfer the property unless HUD approves it, and HUD only approve it if another nonprofit should acquire the property, and it has to be a single entity ownership. And in this particular property, the reason that this was built, it's for the very low income elderly and disabled. The corresponding 811 PRAC is for disabled only, and they're very, very small units.
Let me pick up on that point that there's even a prohibition of transfer without approval. And kind of tie into a question I asked counsel. isn't there something about valuing these properties that's almost at a level of fiction? I mean, if they can't transfer the property, then as a matter of real-world fact, you could be in a position of arguing it has a value of zero.
And that's an interesting question. I believe when you look at the old line of cases, the Alliance Towers, Oberlin Manor, and Canton Towers, in all those three cases, those were project-based Section 8 with above-market rents. And for that affirmative increase in the rent over the market, the court stated that we're going to use market rent, market expenses, and market-driven capitalization rate. And that was really going through that history of that time period after the Wynwood case, where we really were a fair market value state based on market rent totally in an income approach. We didn't use lease fee sales. We only used fee simple sales. Of course, that changed with the Berea Board of Education case, where for the first time the court said we can use lease fee. So the fiction is when you are valuing a Section 8 with above market, yes, it is a fiction to use market rent. Here's the problem, though. If you try to utilize that for a LIHTC project, a rural development, or this Section 202 PRAC, if you go to market, that's the really big fiction. And the reason is that the rents, they can never, ever charge a market rent. The rents will always be below market. LIHTC has to be, by definition, below market. Rural development is a basic rent, which is below market. And this Section 202 PRAC is below market. And that gets me into the network restorations case. And the most important thing, that was a Section 8 project. It was a project-based Section 8 with above-the-market rents. The LIHTC overlay was utilized to rehabilitate the property. HUD has no money to rehabilitate the old Section 8 properties. The only money that's available is through the Ohio Housing Finance Agency, known as OFA, for both tax credits and home funds. So when you look at the restrictive covenant from the home funds in the network restorations case, you know what it states? It sets the Section 8 rents control. And the Section 8 rents were above market. So looking at the appraisal, I can understand the confusion. It was a very torturous appraisal that was written. The value and the analysis was correct, but it wasn't a LIHTC project. It only had a LIHTC overlay, and the only time that those LIHTC rents would come and be controlling on the network restorations case as if the HAP agreement went away. And that's what is meant by the overlay. The controlling rents were these above-market rents. So I think the BTA in its decision actually got it wrong, but I can understand it because looking at the appraisal, you think it's a LIHTC project. It isn't. It's a Section 8 project with above-market rents. And that's very different than WOTA because when you look at the whole line of cases, prior to WOTA, everything was always above market. Then finally, the new set of cases where the government has said, we're not going to pay these large rents on these projects. We want to go into the marketplace and find a way to develop apartments for the low income, but we're going to do it through the marketplace, and that's why they have below market rents.
Based on what you're saying, the position could be taken that the court's earlier cases should not be regarded as controlling on these situations because they're just different.
Well, they are different, but so the case law has changed. When we were doing the Canton Towers, Oberlin Manors, and I hate to say I was involved in those cases, that shows how long I've been practicing. At that point in time, the case law was that we used market rent. It changed after the Berea case, and that's why we get to the...
Well, let me ask you the question I asked counsel. The year here at issue is 2013.
The 2013 tax year.
Tax year, and the court has held that the new statute applies to 2013, and Terraza 8 says that the new statute is at least to some degree an override of Berea. Does that affect the analysis of this case?
Well, if you look at the very first, if you go to 2012, the history of 57-1303, in 2012, when they first brought that statute out to overturn the Berea case by putting unencumbered, they didn't have the language that they currently have regarding police power and governmental actions. They added that because when I looked at it, and I was very honest with those in the affordable housing industry, saying, if that's the case, you're going to have, with below market rent projects, you're going to have the fiction of going to market rent, and they can't afford to pay taxes on a market
rent.
Let
me ask you a factual question. Does the record show here who pays the property tax? Does the owner or the federal government?
The owner pays all of the expenses.
Do they get reimbursed by the HUD?
No. Okay. Here's what happens. They get their income. The total is $407 a month. That's all the income they get. They may get some miscellaneous revenue from maybe some washing machines, but very nominal amount. They are required to pay all of their expenses. They have to pay utilities. They have to make sure that the property is kept clean and maintained. All the expenses are paid. And those rentals are frozen for the first 3 years.
All the expenses are paid by the owner.
The expenses are paid by the owner. The one thing they don't have, though, they don't have a mortgage payment because of the grant. And that's the only way these things work, is the fact that they don't have a mortgage. Now, LIHTC properties do have mortgages on the property, and Rural Development have mortgages, but typically because they are opting for the very low income, they have a 1% mortgage. So that's why the rents may be a little different. And I think it's important to note, because network restorations is a project-based Section 8, I think the court is aware that since 1983, we no longer have project-based new projects being built that. We have the voucher system. And this is where it's interesting. Say I'm a tenant and I have a voucher. And if I can go to Canton Towers, which is a project-based Section 8 with above market rent, or say network restorations, I take my voucher. And what does the property owner get? The property owner gets that above market rent. If I take my same voucher to a LIHTC project, I can, that voucher, the property owners only get the LIHTC rent. If I take that voucher to a rural development project, the property only gets the basic rent. And if I take the voucher to this property, the property owner gets only $407 a month. So you can see why the switch to the voucher is that they were trying to reel in the costs of affordable housing and putting it back into the marketplace so that we could have good, safe, decent housing for not only families, but for the elderly and disabled. And that's what our particular project is. And I think that change to 571303 is a very important change because it recognizes and carves out an exception for these situations where we have properties that will never be able to charge market rent. They have to have rents that are well below market. And that is, when it comes to the Board of Tax Appeals, prior to the network restorations case, it was fairly easy. And I, from the standpoint, the first thing the court and the BTA would look at is, what are the controlling rents? Because these projects have different overlays all the time. So who controls the rent? And if the rent is below market, I think it's appropriate to use the rents, the restricted rents in place. If the rent is above market, then it's appropriate to use market rent. And you can't use market rent for all affordable housing because the affordable housing industry has changed so much. And I think if you look at the rent, what's the controlling rent? Is it at market? If it's at market, then you have no problem. If it's above market, go to market. And if it's below market, you should use that. And it is simple and it's easy approach for any appraiser to utilize. The only other items that we would like to raise to the court is that Network Restorations 3 is under reconsideration. There is language, as Ms. Gorey stated, about LIHTC properties, And I think if you look at that appraisal, I can see the confusion that you might think LIHTC rents were above market or at market, but they aren't, and they legally can't. The restrictions in place will not permit that. In addition, we would ask you to really look at the differences in affordable housing. So all subsidized housings aren't the same, and all HUD projects aren't the same. And in this particular case, we did raise, as additional authority, the Regency W Apartments case, and because that particular case really spells out the differences between a LIHTC and a Section 8. And since Network Restorations was a Section 8 case, we believe that it shouldn't apply, and I don't think it overturned Wota Ivy Glen as the council for the county has alleged. I would hope it wouldn't, because it's very important for us to keep good, safe, decent housing.
Is there an issue for this court in any of this as to the question of whether or not the Ohio local government should be called upon to help with these federal subsidies or not?
Here's the thing. All the taxes are all our money. So our federal tax dollars are being used judiciously. Our local money is also being used judiciously. We are a country that I'm proud to live in because we care about the elderly, we care about low-income families, and they live in good, decent housing. We have people that come out of those projects, and they are, you know, able to do wonderful things with their life. They're not in really bad, horrible housing, and I think that's a very important consideration. The comments that were made in the Appley's brief, because ambulances go to senior facilities more than they do to family facilities, that to me is discrimination against the elderly. I would hope we don't worry about that, but it's part of our citizenship to take care of our citizens. And I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bauernschmidt. Ms. Gorey, you've reserved 44 seconds. You may take an entire minute to explain all subsidized housing.
Just one comment. I think how the expenses are set here is the PRAC covers. They set the total amount of expenses. They take what tenant rent is paid, and then the difference they pay in the PRAC. So, in fact, the federal regulations do allow for HUD to pay an amount for real property taxes. That was a question that was asked. And then, finally, in this case, there was a I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. What we're actually asking for here, we filed the motion to remand, and I raised this in my motion to remand. The auditor did value the property with a cost approach. He didn't know it was a subsidized property. He doesn't go to the county recorder's office and look at private deed restrictions that are recorded. However, we're totally acknowledging that his value might not be okay under network restoration, so we've requested that the court remand the entire case back to the BTA for both parties to now present evidence that would comply with network restorations. And so that's what we've asked for in our motion to remand.
Okay,
thank you very
much. Your time's expired. Thank you. This case will be submitted, and the court will advise the parties of its decision.